It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome everyone to episode number 7 of Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden, a 50-year retrospective, the early years of the WWWF, the WWF, and the WWE, the mecca of professional wrestling, a building that every wrestler wanted to wrestle in. We record one show a month to coincide with the 50th anniversary of a wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden. And to help us look back, as always, the man who went to every wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden for 5 years straight, starting in August 30th, 1971, Mr. Wrestling himself, John Arizzi. John, how are you doing today?
Good. I mean, that introduction certainly makes me old.
It is 50 years.
50 years ago.
Yeah, it is 50 years. But let me ask you first, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling great.
Okay. Last time we talked, you were just getting still over the COVID. You had COVID, cough, and everything's still going, but you're still going good.
That was not a good few weeks in my life, let's put it that way. And, you know, as far as COVID goes, I mean, I really feel back to full 100% physical capacity mentally. I don't think I'll ever be there again. You know, I think I'll always have COVID brain fog, but maybe that's just an excuse because I'm getting older.
But you actually feel that. You actually start, because I have friends who had COVID too, who go through the same thing.
Now the brain fog is done too. I'm just feeling old.
Yeah.
At 65, you know, and then you talk about, we're going to be reviewing shows from 50 years ago. And I spent a few hours over the weekend, you know, digging into negatives and looking at some more, vintage photographs that I shot. And I'm like, man, looking at the people and what they were dressed in, it's like, I'm friggin' old. I'm 65. This is crazy. Did you ever think that you'd be doing a podcast with some old dude to talk about wrestling from 50 years ago, Tim?
We didn't know what a podcast was back then. We knew nothing. And the funny thing about it, when you do think back about these days, you don't think about how you were dressed or how you looked. You think about how you look today. You know, you think you look good, and all of a sudden you look back, you go, "Ooh, I was wearing that. Ugh, what was I thinking?" But at the time, that was hip. And as always, we bring this episode to you free of charge. 50 years to the date of a house show at Madison Square Garden. But if you want to hear this show early and you want to support the podcast, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/John Arizzi. And it's not just a podcast. There's a whole lot more, right, John?
There's so much stuff up there, Tim. Over the weekend, I uploaded some really interesting stuff. I went back into the archives and uploaded a few college shows. I found a really interesting appearance by Vern Gagne and Chris Taylor on the old Mike Douglas show. And I think that was from 1976. So I'm going to put that up for patrons coming up this week. It was really interesting. And Jerry Lewis was on set, which made it even more hilarious. So it was an interesting find for me over the weekend, because that's what I do. I listen to stuff, and it was at the end of one of my college shows, and then it segued into this Mike Douglas show, because I used to think anything about wrestling that was on TV on my cassette player. And I was like, well, yeah, this sounds like something I think the patrons would enjoy. So that'll be going up. But, you know, we have I just put up a photo set of the night Bruno Sammartino beat Stan Stasiak on December 1st, 1973. And I put that up for the upper tier patron members. So there's always stuff going up there. Just to give you a little idea of what patrons get, with the starting point, and it is $5 a month, and that gets you the entire archives of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight radio show. It gets you early access to this podcast, early access to the weekly John Arizzi's Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast. Here's what I put up just this weekend, because I upload new content for patrons every Sunday. I put up a video that was from the IWAS tour 1993 of Southeast Asia, and it's a real interesting one. It was it was me actually leaving home to go to Southeast Asia. So there's footage of my mom, There's footage of my sister Donna. There's footage of us going to the airport, checking in to customs. We had this holding area. Jake the Snake Roberts, Conan, Greg Valentine, Bob Orton, and others, and Nancy Sullivan, so many others. And then the flight over to our first stop, which was Singapore, on Singapore Airlines. I have some footage on the plane with the performers. And then getting to our destination, because we were doing a big press conference there. So there's a lot of really neat footage in that thing. And it's really personal to me because it's my mom. Yeah. And she's like, oh, I'm going to miss you. And, you know, and I'm in the van complaining. I already spent most of the money I made from this tour already, you know. So, and my sister's there and Bruce Jacobs, who was the producer at the time. And I took him overseas as well. So that went up. Pro Wrestling Spotlight college show from October 76. Then I found another really interesting New Center for Boston, WBZ, did a feature on pro wrestling in February 76. And they were kind of, it was almost like a semi-expose. And Bruno Sammartino let them have it in this interview, talking about, in his opinion, how wrestling is real. And then, of course, Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast early. And that one ties into a lot of the stuff I posted because the new Pro Wrestling Spotlight regular podcast covers the origins of the show from the me listening to wrestling radio in the time period of 72, 73 on WHBI and gives the whole history of how that lit my fire and me wanting to do a talk show. And then we go into the college days, and then we go into my entire three incarnations of Pro Wrestling Spotlight. So all for patrons, you know, that show, the Orange show is up there for everybody, obviously. And we're about to get into the sex scandal stuff and me breaking up with Russo. So each and every week is going to be a real interesting ride. So, yeah, you know. You never know what you're going to find when you start listening to old cassettes.
I love the behind-the-scenes footage. It's not the plane ride from hell, is it?
No. Well, actually, we had a couple of incidents, you know, in the beginning, right? Even before we got on the flight, Jake the Snake Roberts took out his albino python, and he didn't even check it with customs. And he takes it out of the bag and he starts chasing around our Singapore Airlines representative that was assigned to us. And then they confiscated the snake from him, and he didn't get it back. We had to get a new snake for him once we got overseas. And then on the flight, everyone was drinking, you know, party atmosphere, or whatever, we're all going. And we were stopping in Germany before we took off and completed our flight to Singapore. And Cowboy Bob Orton had way too much to drink. And, you know, a lot of the wrestlers wore those fanny packs back in the day, and some still do. But Orton had lost his or misplaced his, and he was screaming that the flight attendant, these beautiful flight attendants on Singapore Airlines, some of the most stunning women I've ever met. And he's like yelling and screaming at them that they stole his fanny pack. And it caused quite a ruckus. And then when we landed in Germany, armed guards came on the plane, and it was the guy that was assigned to us from the touring company was able to talk them down, and Orton found his fanny pack. It was in the overhead luggage, where you put your overhead luggage.
Yeah,
it was there, and he got on his hands and knees and kind of begged them to please, I'm sorry, you know. And if you ask him that today, he won't recall it. I mean, you know, he was lit. But that was an interesting. It wasn't the plane ride from hell, but it was close.
Well, you can check out some of this footage only if you're on Patreon, patreon.com/John Arizzi. Go check out the backstage footage. Go check out the footage. And also, it's a great companion piece to this podcast and the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast, because you are loading things up that we talk about. You loaded up the Jimmy Valiant interview you did. You load up pictures of Freddie Blassie. So there's always something that is a companion to this podcast.
Oh, absolutely. And I found a bunch of the little Instamatic photographs that I took back in the day that I'll be putting up for patrons as well. I mean, these are the early shots of me shooting at ringside. And I found the Pedro Morales, Bruno Sammartino versus Tanaka and Fuji match from October 15th, 1972, right after their Shea Stadium match.
All right. Something to look forward to.
Yes.
All you got to do, patreon.com/John Arizzi. Support the podcast. Join the community. And let's get into this week. We have big things this week. First of all, it's John's dad. First wrestling show with John. You know, I got to say, it's his second wrestling show with John. The first one was 5 years to the month that you didn't get in to Madison Square Garden with your dad because you're too young at the time, correct?
Yeah, that was February 67. We went and we couldn't get in because I was only 10 and you had to be 14 to get in. So they stopped me at the door with my dad, his friend Mike, and my friend John. And now that I think about it, it was my friend's sister too. So it was five of us. We couldn't get in, and that was quite a heartbreaking experience. And I almost never got over it, Tim. I, you know, let it fester in my mind, and what a depression that I sunk into for most of my adolescence because I couldn't get into the Garden.
But then you finally did, and tonight is the night, which we're going to talk about. Also, the return of Bruno Sammartino to the Garden. This is a big deal.
A huge deal for me. And by the way, those last comments were kind of, I was being a little facetious if you didn't.
I understood. I got you.
But yeah, huge deal. Bruno Sammartino had not seen him live up to that point. He had not appeared at Madison Square Garden in a year. You know, really, I think it was February 8th when Morales won the title in 71. And then he had no shows, I don't think. I could be wrong. But anyway, for me, that was the first time. And seeing Bruno Sammartino. So that was the deal for me, that I was like more excited about Bruno than anything else on that card.
And this card starts a trend for the WWF that is kind of crazy, but we've been working to figure out why they were doing some of the things they were doing. Back in the day, the WWF worked months in advance. You booked a card out months in advance. You got guys come in months in advance. It was a whole thing about climbing up the card, going against a champion, and then going down the card. So it really was very well booked. Not saying today is not well booked, but there's so many more injuries and things today, so you can't book that far out. You don't know what's going to happen to the guys.
Right.
But this was the card that started it all, as in almost like one-off bookings. And let me give you a little example. So last month, they drew 22,090 fans to Madison Square Garden. That's for a Monday night house show. That is like today, like WrestleMania numbers. But like WrestleMania, you don't know who's going to be on the card before you buy the tickets. Back in the day, it was all about the marquee. Who's on the marquee? Who's going to put people in the seats? And the one person that always did it was Bruno Sammartino. Bruno headlined or co-mained events on the marquee at Madison Square Garden for 159 times. That's once a month for over 12 years. So his name meant something. So bringing Bruno back was important because they were working another angle on the other side, and that was with Pedro. They're trying to build up Pedro. And the main event this time with Pedro was against Baron Miguel Cicluna. So, John, if people don't know who Baron Miguel Cicluna is, tell them who he is.
Sure. But first, I want to make a quick correction because I've already researched it as you were talking there. Bruno did come back to take on Blackjack Mulligan on July 24th, 1971. So it was the show before I started going.
Gotcha.
And he beat Mulligan in 1 minute and 4 seconds.
Not really a great match.
I wouldn't say, but Bruno was there for a minute and 4 seconds. He probably got a nice payday. But getting back to Baron Miguel Cicluna. Cicluna was a guy that when I first started watching wrestling and when I really started getting into it in the 1966 era, he was a guy who, a top heel, not necessarily a main eventer, but he was a tag team champion with Smasher Sloan. And that was back in the day. And but he was always a constant, and he always had that allure of the roll of dimes that he kept in his tights. That was his gimmick, and it was this simple gimmick. He'd reach down and he'd hit his opponent over the head with a loaded fist, which is with a roll of dimes or quarters inside this fist. But he was somebody that stayed around for a while, and he never really made what I would call a full-time living in the business either. I mean, he worked for many, many years in the union driving a delivery truck for one of the New York newspapers for many years. So I got to know him a little bit. I mean, he went to at least one of my conventions.
I remember seeing him. I think it was the third one he was at.
Yeah, he might have been at the third one, and he was there with Davey O'Hannon and a few other guys. And I know there's a picture of Mick Foley with Davey and with Baron Cicluna. So, yeah, I mean, but he was a constant, a mainstay, and he appeared on many shows.
But he wasn't the guy that put people in the seats. Would you call him
No. I wouldn't say he was a box office draw.
Exactly. And we're talking about back in the day, when you put your name on a marquee, that's what they're looking at. They're looking for those names. So I'm sure Bruno was up there. But then Baron Miguel Cicluna getting a title shot wasn't something that would put people in the seats against Pedro Morales. And we're going to show that in a second, why it turned out to be. But also, he wasn't just Baron Miguel Cicluna. Him and King Curtis had just beaten Carl Gotch and Rene Goulet for the WWF tag team titles. So now you have a tag team champion going against the heavyweight champion. It sounds like a good idea, but I don't, you know, even knowing the Baron, he's not going to draw that kind of crowd.
No, not certainly a sellout, but you would think with Bruno on the marquee, it would have been a sellout, but it wasn't. But it was ironic, yes, that that February 1st, 72 in Philadelphia for TV match, Cicluna and King Curtis defeated Carl Gotch and Rene Goulet, who had just really won the title back in December at the Garden. And they had teamed up for a very short period of time, and then they win the title. They might have only had a few TV matches. And I was thinking about that reign because Carl Gotch was such a great technical wrestler. They were fan favorites, and they won, and then all of a sudden they lose. But that might have had something to do. There was something that happened because Carl Gotch left the territory abruptly, and they were building Carl up to be this, you know, technical babyface, tough guy, shooter, and then he did like three or four shows. Then he gets into the tag match. I think the, you know, we're going to go back here just a second, just so I could kind of look at my notes. But it was kind of when I was reviewing everything, it was more like, wow, Gotch never appeared at the Garden anymore after they lost the titles on February 1st, 72. That was the end of it for him. So maybe, you know, I'd love to know the real story about what happened with Carl Gotch and why he left. And maybe that's another reason why the straps were, you know, hastily maybe put on, you know, the waist of Curtis and Cicluna. Because Gotch basically came in and he made his debut at Madison Square Garden on the show that the very first show that I attended, which was August the 30th when he beat the Black Demon. And then he comes back the second month, October 25th, in a singles match, and he beats Beautiful Bobby. Then in November 15th, 71, he's back again, and he defeats Mike Monroe. And then all of a sudden, December 6th, the very next show, he's there with Rene Goulet, and they beat Tarzan Tyler and Luke Graham to win the titles. January 72, the show we covered a few months ago, he was there again, and they beat the Rugged Russians, defending their title. And then by the next month, the show that we're covering today, no Carl Gotch, gone, never to be seen again.
That's crazy. And then going back to like the Miguel Cicluna having a tag team match, I can understand him having a tag team title, but pushing him to the Garden, to the main event of the Garden, he was never a main eventer. He was a mid-carder at best, and maybe back in the day, he was more of a main eventer, but this is now 72. He's not the same guy anymore.
No, I mean, you know, the only person that could really answer these questions is Vince McMahon Sr., who's no longer with us because he was the booker, and Vince booked way in advance, too. I mean, most times. But this could have been a way to make Pedro strong, you know, to give him some not the most difficult of matches, to let him go over strong against Cicluna, let him go over strong against King Curtis. And then, you know, it was kind of a lot of these throwaways, Professor Tanaka. They were throwing heels at him that he was beating quite handily and pretty easily back then. And, you know, whether or not the Bruno Pedro angle and their eventual match at Shea Stadium had anything to do with it, it could have been. I don't know. I wish I you know, would have more inside information about that. But I think that, yeah, getting Morales strong, putting him over, giving him some pretty quick victories would elevate him, maybe trying to draw a fan base to him. Because there was still a lot of resentment that Morales was champion from the non-Hispanic fans, because Bruno was their hero. So maybe they were trying to make it, like, give him some strong performances to maybe attract more mainstream fans to get on his side.
Well, that would make a lot of sense, him going in, you know, going up against the legend Bruno at Shea in the future.
Right.
If they plan out so well, Why are they doing this?
That could have been a reason why they did the Bruno Pedro thing too, because, you know, Morales, and because he, you know, he didn't beat Bruno, but Bruno didn't beat him either. It was a draw. And then the next match, you know, they're hugging at Madison Square Garden. They're embracing. Bruno's, you know, lifting his hand up again. Maybe it was just kind of a struggle because he was inconsistent with the attendance figures around the horn. And then finally the decision was made in 73. Well, maybe, you know, maybe the guys had his run. And then when Bruno agreed to come back, you know, Pedro had a nice little run there. But there could have been a lot of reasons. I mean, I wish we knew. I mean, I wish Morales was still around to talk about it. But unfortunately, he's not. And Bruno, of course, is not. And Morales's wife is still alive. And she's still pretty coherent. Don Leibel talked to her not too long ago, had a really nice conversation with her. But she didn't really go to the matches a lot either, you know, and she didn't have a big recall of her heading to the garden with him every month, you know.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
What we're really getting into is that how important the Garden is for the WWE.
Oh, yeah.
So important. And for them to lose, for example, last month, 22,090. This month, 18,300. That's roughly 4,800 left empty seats. So
the other thing we got to think about, Tim, also, because Madison Square Garden also had a big walk-up, especially with the Hispanic fans, with the Puerto Rican fans. Maybe the weather. Maybe there was snow. Maybe there was a snowstorm. Who the hell knows what could have happened to keep that crowd? With Bruno, I'm saying because of Bruno there, you would think that Bruno would have sold the place out just for him to be on in that co-main event.
The return of Bruno, yeah, you would think, and this is why we get back to the marquee. When you put your name on marquee, it does mean something. And walk-ups, that was a normal thing.
I'm going to get to another point here, okay? July 24th, 1971, Bruno comes back for the first time to beat Blackjack Mulligan in a minute four. Attendance, 21,912. Sellout.
Wow.
So here we go in February. Bruno's back again with a show that was not, it didn't sell out. It was 18,301. Maybe weather had something to do with it. Who knows? Or maybe not.
Well, let me ask you this. How about TV? What was the buildup for this Garden show on TV? What were they talking more about, like Bruno on the card, or were they talking more about Pedro or Miguel Cicluna? How were they promoting the show back then?
The promos was Bruno's return, and he might have done I don't even know if he did any TV promos for this. But it was, all pushing. Bruno's coming back. And, of course, the main event, Cicluna, Morales. I don't remember. They could have done it, but I don't remember any angles or any, you know, looking, pushing Cicluna during the weeks preceding this main event as some type of monster heel that could possibly even have a chance to beat Morales. The only thing that they did was, you know, they gave him the tag team titles. But once again, you know, that was like, okay, they're tag team champions, but has really nothing to do with if he could beat the world champion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's get into today's show. Madison Square Garden, March 13th, 1972. The return of John's dad. How did this all come about, John? How did you get your dad to come to a match with you?
Well, I've been going with my friend Frank Favalli each month, and he's the guy that took me to my first show. And, there were times where his interest waned a little bit, and then he would come back. But this show, I really wanted my dad to kind of experience, you know, the joy that I was having for pro wrestling. And he knew it since the 60s, obviously, with that ill-fated attempt to show up at the Garden in February 67. So he did agree to come with me, and it was kind of exciting for me. You know, I know my dad is not a train guy, and I think I got that from him. He hated trains, buses, any public transportation. He had a Oldsmobile 98, which was a really nice mint car, and I think it was his first new car ever. And I remember driving with him to the matches in the Oldsmobile 98, you know, and then parking and going into the Garden, sitting down, and, you know, he was just kind of there looking around. And so it was kind of cool for me, you know, but he didn't really get into it the way I did, you know, because at one point I turned to my left and looked at him and he was sleeping.
He was probably trying to think, why does this guy come? Why does my son come here every month?
I mean, to give credit where credit's due, I mean, he might have taken off from work because he worked an overnight shift at a place called Eastern Trucking. And he also had a secondary job, which I've talked about in my book. You know, he was a numbers runner, is what they called it back in the day. So he was always working, you know, and there were, you know, times where he'd only come home a couple times a week. And his mom, my grandma, lived in Cypress Hills in Brooklyn. And so he would stay there, especially because he worked an overnight shift, and he would come home 6-7 in the morning. And then on the weekends he worked, you know, because that's when the collections, and he had to make the, you know, had to drop off the money to the boss. And I used to really have a lot of anxiety every Garden show on a Sunday night, because I relied on him to give me my money to go to the show. I mean, it was $20, $25, whatever it was. And if he, you know, I'd wait, and sometimes I'd stay up all night waiting for him to pull up. And as long as I heard that car, you know, and he revved the motor before he shut it off. Once I heard that by the window, then I knew that, yeah, I'd get my money for wrestling and go. And because I was there 5 years in a row, what it more than that, you know, my dad was pretty consistent coming home when he needed to.
I liked when you talked about driving in. If people don't know, Madison Square Garden, like we talked about, is on, you know, Manhattan Island, and the best way to get there is train. But when they started having the Long Island become the suburbs, they really pushed back in the day people driving places, okay? So you want to drive to the beach, or you want to drive to the stadium, or you want to drive these places. And your dad seemed like he really embraced the driving. Oh, we can drive, because they had new highways and all these different roads now on Long Island you can drive on. So it had to be a pretty cool deal. Oh, I get to drive now. I'm driving in. He took advantage of it anytime he could.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I was born and raised in Brooklyn. And then when we finally moved out to the island in 1964 to Long Island, it was a little difficult for him, the commute, because at that time he also had a grocery store in Manhattan, in Brooklyn, rather, in Cypress Hills, in the same building. My grandmother owned the building. But, you know, it was that commute. And even though there wasn't the massive traffic there is now, it was still a, you know, 30 to 45 minute drive. And but he loved to drive, and you know, he drove everywhere. He did.
Where did you get tickets for the show? Do you remember where you were sitting?
I was in the loge, the section. I call them section 100. Some people call them the loge, but they on the tickets it said loge. So it was not ringside. It was a level up. It was the right side of where the entrance was, where the guys came out, and we had fairly good seats. It was fairly good seats. I mean, those were kind of cool. If you weren't taking photographs or, you know, the loge was always a good place to sit. But, yeah, he liked the seats, and I think I got him a Ticketmaster.
There you go. Love Ticketmaster.
Or Ticketron.
Ticketron. All right, first match of the night, Jimmy Valiant fought Joe Nova to a 20-minute draw.
Yeah, Valiant was, you know, hanging on, you know, he would eventually come back and win the tag team titles multiple times with his brother, Johnny Valiant, and later his other brother, Jerry, or whatever. But Valiant was there. Joe Nova, you know, a good hand, as they would call it, a good preliminary guy. And I think in some territories, he even won more than he did in the WWF.
Let's go to match number two. Pampero Firpo beat Ben Justice. No time limit given.
Yeah, I mean, this could have been a match where Firpo beating Ben Justice, and Justice was from the Detroit area, as in Firpo was highly active, very active in the Detroit area as well. So he had wrestled Ben Justice a number of times there. And I believe that was the only time Ben was at the Garden. And it could have been that they traveled together. Who knows? I mean, they could have been driving. Who knows? I don't remember even if the – I don't have the program, but I don't know if Ben's name was even in the program. Could have been.
He could have just showed up. That's the way it goes back then. Could have just showed up.
Yeah, there was few occasions like that, but that did happen.
Pampero Firpo, you did an interview with his daughter. Where can people find that?
Mary. His daughter, Mary.
Where can people find that?
It's on my YouTube channel. Pro Wrestling Spotlight Live. It was, you know, youtube.com/Pro Wrestling Spotlight, and it's there. We did a really great interview with her. It was 2020. What a wonderful woman she is, and what great fond memories of her dad, and what a great guy Pampero Firpo was to his family.
That's always amazing hearing that, because so many stories of wrestlers are, I really didn't know my dad. He was on the road all the time. I didn't be around my dad. So he was definitely a family man.
Yes, he was. Family was first and foremost in his life.
That's pretty cool. Match number three, Professor Toru Tanaka defeated Rene Goulet in 7 minutes, 45 seconds.
Yeah, Tanaka was somebody they were having win because he was eventually going to wrestle Morales as well. And Goulet had just dropped the tag team titles with his partner, Carl Gotch, and Rene got soundly defeated by Tanaka in this match.
And Rene Goulet seems like he's a company guy. He seems like he's always doing something for the company. He'll win the title, he'll lose the title, whatever you need him to do, he's that guy.
Yeah, and he came back many years later to be a road agent. So he spent a lot of years with the company during the 90s and 2000s.
Match number four, Ernie the Cat Ladd fought Sonny King to a draw.
Yes, Ernie the Cat Ladd, always... a big presence, big guy, the King, Ernie Ladd, with the taped up thumb, and Sonny King was also getting a push because he was eventually going to win the tag team title with Chief J Strongbow. They actually will be covering their victory at Madison Square Garden when he and Strongbow won the titles from Curtis and Cicluna in May. So we'll be getting into that in future episodes. But both those guys, 20-minute draw, two really good workers, and Ernie Ladd had just all the charisma in the world.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Was he one of those guys you put on the marquee and go, oh, Ernie Ladd's going to be here, I got to go see him?
To me, he was always a special attraction. And, you know, I was always fascinated with his NFL career. He was a big, big guy. And just he was good on promos. And he was very believable heel.
Match number five, Chief J Strongbow and Victor Rivera defeated my boys, the Rugged Russians, in the best out of 2 out of 3 falls match. 2-0.
It's interesting that Strongbow and Rivera teamed up against the Russians, and even though they won, you know, 2 falls in a row, given the fact that Sonny King was going to be teaming up with Strongbow and winning the titles, you would think that maybe it should have been Strongbow and Sonny King against the Russians and maybe putting Rivera in against Ladd. So I don't know. That's just kind of speculation on my part and a little bit of a... Why didn't they put Strongbow with King together? Because they were going to win the title in just another 3 months.
And this is the last match for the Rugged Russians at Madison Square Garden. What I liked about the Rugged Russians is, I know, they always seem to be the 2 out of 3 fall guys. They're always doing 2 out of 3 fall matches. So somewhere in the card, they'll be doing a 2 out of 3 fall match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were there. They were mainstays for quite a while, at least half a year. At the Garden in that 2 out of 3 fall tag team match situation.
Match number six, King Curtis with Captain Lou Albano in his corner defeated Gorilla Monsoon when the match was stopped because of blood.
Yeah, I do remember my dad perking up for this one because of how the crowd was. The crowd was going crazy. And this is what happened with a lot of guys. They'd they'd beat one of the top baby faces right before Morales or Bruno. They would do that. They would give him a rub. And Monsoon was beloved. He was probably number two baby face in the company, you know, that was working full time. You know, Bruno was an attraction at that point. And Curtis busted him open. It was, and my dad, I mean, my dad was like, ah, that's fake blood. I was like, I don't think it's fake, Dad, you know, because it was pouring out of his head. And my dad, what happened? I mean, you know, he got hit, could have been a ring post or whatever. I'm not too sure. But when he gigged himself, he must have hit something because he had what they would call in the industry a gusher. And the match was stopped due to blood. But it was so alarming that somebody ran into the ring. A fan ran into the ring and wrapped a T-shirt or a towel or something around Monsoon's head. And there was no security in the ring. You know, they eventually got the guy and brought him out. But it made it look like there was an assault here. And this guy was coming to Gorilla Monsoon to stop the blood. And, of course, Monsoon couldn't do anything because he's laying there selling it. That was one of those memorable things of that night for me. And I do remember in a few months later in a wrestling magazine, they actually had a picture of the fan cradling Monsoon's head with the towel around. It was crazy.
And he wasn't part of the show. He wasn't part of the...
No. I mean, there were no barricades set up. So if someone was brave enough to want to jump into the ring, you could. The security really got aware of the crowds when right before Morales's match, because that's when things really got crazy. But I was surprised that they didn't jump in sooner, but it was very effective. It really was. And the fact that Monsoon had to be carried out, you know, gushing blood, was just probably the most memorable thing of the night for me, outside of seeing the living legend at the time.
Speaking of the living legend, match number 7, Bruno Sammartino defeated Smasher Sloan in 9 minutes, 53 seconds by submission with the backbreaker.
Yeah, the trademark move for Bruno Sammartino, the backbreaker, the same move that he beat Buddy Rogers with in May 17th, 1963, a move that he used a lot, but not that frequently towards this part of his career. He kind of had given it up, and when he eventually came back and won the title, he rarely used the backbreaker except for a few occasions. But to see him, to see the crowd react when he came out of the locker room and jogged to the ring and the place erupted and Smasher Sloan, I still don't know to this day why they chose him as a returning opponent for Bruno Sammartino, because Sloan had not been seen for a while. And I do remember now that Sloan did have some TV victories proceeding up to the show. So they put him on TV. They gave him 2 or 3 wins, you know, leading up to the Bruno match. But it wasn't somebody that you would immediately think, well, yeah, he's going to be against Bruno. I mean, why? And then he leaves the territory, you know, shortly thereafter anyway.
The booking. Still don't understand that whole booking. I want to go back for a second. The backbreaker. You know, changing your finishing move. That became a thing over the years. Bruno did that. Mick Foley did that, going from, what was it, the nasty plunge? What did he call it? That move that he used to do, a flip out of the ring?
Yeah.
And then he,
I don't know exactly what he called
and
it.
And then he changed it. So changing...
And he had the mandible claw, obviously.
Exactly. One that's easier to do. Did you find that with a lot of wrestlers changing their moves as they get older because they realized the move that they were doing, they can't do it anymore, or it would shorten their careers if they kept on doing that move?
I don't know, but you think the backbreaker, I mean, that really isn't that's really not a difficult move to execute, because all you're doing is you're lifting the guy up, you're putting him in a grip around his stomach, and you're lifting him up. And Bruno was a power lifter. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't difficult for him to lift anybody up. I mean, for God's sakes, he lifted up Haystacks Calhoun once, not in the backbreaker, but he lifted him up to slam him. And that was quite a feat back then. But I don't know why they went away from the backbreaker. I don't know, because I thought that was a very effective move. And when I was a kid watching Bruno on TV and him putting someone in the backbreaker, I mean, that was it. I mean, that was it. He was done. The guy was going to tap or whatever. It wasn't even tapping out. It was just, I give up. I mean, at the time. But it was, I always felt that that backbreaker could have been used more often. But who knows what was going on with Bruno? Maybe there was some stuff going on health-wise from where he couldn't get that lift up the way he used to.
The backbreaker, also known as the bear hug, correct?
No. The bear hug's different. The bear hug is when you're facing your opponent and you have him in this hug. You're hugging him face to face, squeezing and trying to force a submission. The backbreak is you're lifting somebody up over you and you're holding them over your head and you're putting them on top of your shoulder and you're squeezing the abdomen and it causes somebody to give up.
Okay. So maybe that's why, because that seems like you're very unbalanced. Your back is unbalanced and you're in the ring at the same time. So
yeah. And Bruno used the bear hug throughout his career.
Gotcha. Now, I was wondering, I was like the backbreaker. I was thinking the backbreaker. What's the one where you put your leg out and you throw somebody on your leg? That's a backbreaker, right?
I don't get you. Put your leg out.
You know, like you put your knee, so you go like down on one knee and you slam someone down on your knee.
That's kind of a backbreaker too. I mean, yeah. It's literally called a backbreaker. It wasn't the same type of backbreaker as when you would lift somebody on your shoulders.
Okay, so both moves are called the backbreaker, but the submission hold was...
For demonstration purposes, Tim. None of people can't see this, but...
And thank God you're not doing it to me, so go on, demonstrate without me. Okay.
Can you see it?
I can see it. We'll put this on Patreon, and who is it? Is that Buddy Rogers?
That's when he won the title, yeah.
Okay, so the backbreaker is over your shoulder, and then it's kind of like, oh gosh, how do you explain
you're holding
that?
Holding him up over your shoulder, and you're squeezing and squeezing and squeezing, so the guy, if he didn't give up, his back would snap like a twig, as Freddie Blassie would say.
There you go. Now I get it. Now I know what the move looks like. And we'll put that up on the Patreon so you get an idea what the backbreaker looks like. If you don't know, like myself, I was mistaken. I thought it looked like something else.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Match number 8. Here we go. WWF champion Pedro Morales pinned Baron Miguel Cicluna with Captain Lou Albano in 11 minutes, 34 seconds.
To be honest with you, I don't remember a hell of a lot about this match. There could have been a early departure as well with my dad, you know, because obviously he fell asleep at the show. And I don't remember anything about the match. So we might have left early to beat the traffic or to who knows what. All I know is I got to see Bruno. And the reason I don't, because I remember those other matches. I remember Monsoon getting bloodied up. I remember Bruno obviously coming out. But I don't have any real recollection of the Morales-Cicluna match. I do have a photo of them in the ring before the match started, because I do remember Cicluna wearing his title. I do remember now. There you go. I remember Cicluna wearing his title belt and Morales his, obviously. But I don't remember anything about the match other than that. And we might have left early.
Wow. So you're leaving during the championship match because it was...
My dad was like, I want to get out of here. You know, it's like, all right, you saw Bruno, let's go.
And last time you brought your dad, you're like, okay, Dad, from now on, I want to go. I'm staying till the end, no matter what happens.
Yeah. Was the last time he went to, with the exception of my conventions, which he went to, he didn't go to another wrestling match.
Oh, man. Would this be one of those matches that went around the loop? Cicluna and Pedro?
Oh, I'm sure it did. I'm sure they did Sunnyside Gardens or the Westchester County Civic Center. There was a lot of little spot shows around the Northeast that I'm sure that they had a bit of a run in some of the other cities.
And we talked last time about the curfew at the Garden, 11 p.m. curfew. And I've heard reasons other than I've heard the unions would double book, you know, the unions would charge you double if you went past 11 p.m. Have you ever heard that?
That might have been true. I mean, the unions were always, the unions were always tough to work with there at any given time. And that's one of the reasons McMahon left the Garden in recent history because of how costly the unions were. But yeah, I mean, if you go over maybe that certain time where you have the building booked for so many hours, if you run into overtime and you're dealing with unions sometimes are getting 2, 3, 4 times their regular pay for overtime pay.
Yeah.
I mean, me working in a loading dock when I was a kid, when I graduated high school and didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I worked at a dock, but if you went overtime, you'd get paid extra. Yeah, that's a good question. If anybody knows the real reason to it, I mean, just drop us an email or two, you know, just send it to john@mattmemories.com. And if you have the answer to that, or if you ever want to ask any questions about even any of these shows that we've covered, that's a good place to do it. Because, hey, listen, we all don't know everything.
No.
So for 11 p.m. curfew, the union fees could have been a reason why there was a curfew. But I don't know for sure.
How would you rate this show, John?
Still say it was a great show. I mean, between the Monsoon deal and Bruno coming back and, you know, Ernie Ladd and, you know, Firpo, who had become a favorite of mine, it was a show that I really enjoyed in March of 1972.
Not everyone went, but it was a decent show for you. You enjoyed the show. And this is...
Yeah, and you're looking at 18,000. 18,000, it could have been weather, like I said, who knows? But that's still a kind of a healthy crowd. It's not a sellout, but it's still... It's not a money loser. Let's put it that way.
No. And we're going to be seeing this month after month coming up. Pedro's going to get these one-offs coming up. So we're all thinking it's leading to maybe the Shea Stadium show or something with Bruno. We don't know exactly what's happening right now. Maybe they're building them up. But that's another idea, John. We have to, maybe if we can find anybody who's out there, would know about what were their plan was here. What was the plan? Was Pedro not doing as well as they want him to do? Did they want to build him up to be more of a Hercules-like guy because he's going to be going against Bruno? What didn't they see in Pedro that they needed to see in Pedro to get him to go against Bruno?
Yeah, I think the people who know that are all dead, unless you're looking at Vinny Jr., Vince McMahon Jr. But, you know, who else can answer that question? I mean, most of the guys are dead.
Yeah, I mean, knowing the great bookings that we had at the Garden for the main event, for the championship, you know, the Fred Blassies and all these, like, great matches, why are they going with a Miguel Cicluna, a mid-carder at best, and then keep this trajectory until the Bruno match coming up in September at Shea Stadium?
Yeah, all good questions, and I'm sure we'll be speculating, we'll be analyzing, we'll be giving our two cents, as they say, into what we think was going on back then. You know, as the wrestling historian that I am, you know, I am anxiously awaiting future episodes so we can dive deep into this Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden.
Absolutely. And if you want to join the community, love to have you. Help support the podcast so we can bring it to you every week for free. But also, get some more inside stuff. Go to patreon.com/John Arizzi. You're always loading up stuff every time. $5 to get in the door gets you a lot of stuff, right, John?
Oh, it gets you everything, man. It gives you, if you're a fan of wrestling history, and if you're a fan of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight and all the incarnations that we had of it, you could go and listen to 150 episodes of Pro Wrestling Spotlight from April 9th, 1989 through March 15th, 1992. They're all up there right now for you to enjoy. And then, of course, there are those bonuses, those college shows, those early interviews I did from backstage at Madison Square Garden. That stuff is pretty incredible. I mean, for $5, you get the podcast early, and you get the entire archives of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight. For the $10 tier, you get all of the other bonus audio that's attached to it. And then if you want to go up even further to a $25 level, you start getting vintage wrestling magazines mailed to you. You get video access. And then we have a $50 level, and that gives you access to all the 8mm films that we had. And then, you know, at the top tier, $100 a month, you are a producer, you're an executive producer, and you get your name listed on the podcast, the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast. You get four vintage magazines from the 60s, 70s, or 80s every month. So there is a lot of value there, and people are enjoying it. We want more members, and I'm kind of tinkering with the idea, an expansion of this thing in April, because I have to mail magazines out every month, man. If you're at that $25 level, you're getting a vintage magazine, which is probably worth $20 or $25 just for that. Then you have the postage, right? And postage costs have gone way up.
Yeah.
And if you're at the $50 level, you're getting two magazines a month. And if you're at the executive producer level, you're getting four magazines a month. So it kind of pays for your monthly membership just by the magazines. So what I might start doing is mailing them out to everyone quarterly. So it saves a little bit on the postage.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll figure it out. But I also wanted to open it up, you know, to increase the membership. So I'm thinking of a couple of other ideas that would give, you know, people at maybe a lower tier level of a $25 level, maybe a little bit more, something else that'll be special for them. But that helps the production cost of not only this show, but the weekly Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast. And, you know, we have people that we pay for editing, and we have, you know, it's just people that we pay to do our YouTube clips. And so, I mean, all of that is not going in my pocket. It's basically going to pay the expenses, you know.
Keep the lights on.
Because wrestling has never been a money-making proposition for me, Tim.
I know that.
I don't know what it is, Tim. I don't know what it's like to make money in pro wrestling.
Isn't it funny when you see people making money in pro wrestling? We're always like, how are they doing that?
Yeah, because I've always alienated people, not by intention. So I never really, you know, the way I covered the business, always kind of like, you know, who was going to hire me? WWF was going to hire me back then?
Well, I think that's a good point. You alienated yourself because you wanted to be honest with things. And like the whole WWF thing, it was during the steroid era, and they offered you something if you'd stop talking about it, and you didn't want to stop talking about it.
No, I felt it was necessary to do that. But also, even to this day, you find that because you don't hate people, people that hate certain people don't like you or won't cooperate with you because you have patched things up with somebody that they hate.
Isn't it funny? It's like high school.
It is very much like high school. So, I mean, because I brought Vince Russo into the business, I can't get certain guests on my show. You know, Vince Russo is Vince Russo. He did me wrong in so many ways, which I'll be covering. But it doesn't mean that after, you know, all these years, I forgave him and that I have a friendly relationship with him now. But because I do, people are like, you know, why do you like that guy? And da, da, da. And some people just won't even respond to me when I ask them to be on the show because of my ability to not hate people.
Yeah. To move on. Let's call it moving on. I can move on from that.
Oh, yeah. I lost a freaking podcast distributor because I was talking to somebody that he didn't like.
It's crazy. It's just, this is why I love doing the show with you at a distance, because I'm not depending on this as my livelihood. Because we talked about this a long time ago.
Me neither. If I was depending on it for my livelihood, I don't know what I'd be doing, to tell you the truth, you know?
Well, we appreciate your help. If you enjoyed the podcast, please, patreon.com/JohnRizzi. But another way, John, is to follow you on social media. Where can people find you on social media?
Easy. Twitter, @JohnRizzi. Instagram, @JohnRizzi. And I put, what a great pic I put up there. Of course, we're taping this, but it's a picture of me and Mick Foley in his convertible that I think he got from Lindy Motors out on Long Island. And we were driving to the ECW arena, and we were in this convertible, and someone sent me the picture the other day, and I put it up on my socials. But yeah, Instagram @JohnRizzi and Twitter @JohnRizzi. Facebook, you could go and find me there at Matt Memories, facebook.com, Matt Memories. We have two groups there, a public one, a private one. And we have one for Pro Wrestling Spotlight listeners, facebook.com/ Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast and radio show. And of course, YouTube, youtube.com/ Pro Wrestling Spotlight for a lot of video. We got a lot of video stuff up there now.
And what about your auctions?
Oh, yeah. I do the auctions. I'm doing them monthly now. I do them typically the last weekend of each month. And you can go to facebook.com for that / JohnRizzi's Vintage Wrestling Auctions.
Awesome.
And you get magazines from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, autographed pictures sometimes. All kinds of little things I put up there to make the fans happy. And I give them good deals too. Like this last auction I did. All right. For every auction you win, you're going to get a free magazine.
Wow.
So one guy, Jeremy Priest, the executive producer level, he won like 8 of the auctions that I had. So we got 8 extra magazines, plus his 4 magazines from being a patron, and plus the winning items that he won in the auction. So he had a big box of vintage stuff sent to him. And he actually reached out to me today, and he loved everything. And another one of our guys, Matt Walsh, who's an upper tier member, reached out to me, and he got all his magazines, and he was thrilled with them, because I'm like, all right, I'll give you this wrestling review from 1966. You know, I mean, you get some really cool things in there that are really worth the money. And for the auctions, how would you like to start bidding for a vintage wrestling magazine at $5 a pop?
Yep.
And if no one bids against you, you got that magazine for $5.
This could be you, people. This could be you. I've been on there a few times looking at different things, and I've been outbid. Yeah. I've been outbid by people. And I go, okay, I'll let them have this one. But I'm like, John, I want this one. I want this magazine.
Yeah, well, I was doing it weekly, and now I'm just doing it monthly. And
You've got a big closet, John. You got a big closet. You can't doing them weekly, I knew how much you took out of
it. It's in a storage bin. I still have about 1,000 magazines in a storage bin that I still haven't even gone through.
And you can win them. Just what is that? What is that Facebook again, John?
Facebook.com/John Arezzi's Vintage Wrestling Auctions.
Fantastic. And also, let's once again thank Scott Teal and his book, Wrestling in the Garden.
How many times did I reference that today, Tim? Wrestling in the Garden, Scott Teal, CrowbarPress.com. It's my Bible.
Yep.
It's this show's Bible. And if you want to pick up a copy of it, $24.95, CrowbarPress.com. If you're a fan of Madison Square Garden Wrestling and vintage stuff from back then at the Garden, the Mecca, pick up the book, Scott Teal. Tell Scott Teal we sent you.
There you go. Anything else, John?
Where's baseball?
It went the way of wrestling at the Garden. It's not around.
Yeah, I was supposed to be leaving on March 13th, which is the anniversary of this house show, to Florida to meet my nephew and pick him up at Palm Beach International Airport. I was driving to Florida. I was leaving on Friday, the 12th, and no baseball. And now it's like, there's no trip this spring. There's no spring training for me. And at my age, I look forward to that spring training trip more than I do anything else in my life on a yearly basis. It's my sabbatical with my nephew, who lives 950 miles from me, and I haven't seen him since the middle of December. This was what we look forward to. And now the greed of baseball is taking it away, and I'm so angry. You don't know how angry I am, Tim, and I know this is dragging on, but
I was
going to
say, you can go check it out in John Arizzi's baseball podcast coming out this spring.
Well, that is going to be starting up soon. You knew about that, didn't you? Are you kind of giving people teasers here or no?
No, I was just teasing you. Is it really, you have a podcast on baseball coming out?
I have a baseball podcast coming out soon. I think we're taping our first kind of samples. We're going to test. It's with, he's not going to be on every week, but he will be on pretty frequently. And that's John Gibbons, the former manager of the Toronto Blue Jays and New York Mets guy and my old roommate from the Shelby Mets. And we're doing it with a guy named Stu Stone up in Canada from 5-7 Films, who did a fabulous documentary on baseball cards called Jack of All Trades. And he's up in Toronto, and we're going to be pushing Gibby's buttons, talking about what's going on in the game today. Kind of an insider's look at baseball. We haven't come up with a name yet. We have to do that this week because it's like, what do we call it? You know?
Wow. I was just giving you a hard time. I didn't know you really did a podcast on it.
Oh, it is. I think it's going to be big, actually, because John is beloved. He's an icon in Canada. I mean, his baseball knowledge and the fact that he's doing now is, he's a special assignment scout for the Atlanta Braves. And, you know, I got John a book deal with ECW Press that Greg Oliver is co-writing with him. That'll come out next spring training, 2023. Stu is wanting to do a documentary on John up in Canada because of how beloved he was up there. So this is, and John is also wanting to do cool things. You know, he would love to manage again, but you know, the way generationally they're hiring a lot of young guys and John is really old school. So, but he's a great no-nonsense manager who speaks his mind, and for him to kind of kick off this podcast that we're doing about the inside of baseball is going to be really cool to see. And I hope John really enjoys the experience because I'd love to have him on regularly.
Oh, that sounds awesome. And the name of the show, we don't know yet, but...
No, we don't.
We'll let you know as soon as we do.
Because you can't use MLB.
No.
It's trademarked.
No, somebody already has that. Somebody already has that.
Well, I mean, just, you can't. You can't call it. Like, we can't call this the WWF Insider Look Back at Madison Square Garden. We can't call that. But, you know, but we got to find something really cool for it, Tim. So, hey, write me, john@mattmemories.com, if you have a cool idea for a baseball podcast. That's
there
an insider look.
I love it. All right.
And the insider's Gibbons, not me.
Not
so
you.
I'm rambling on, Tim, and I haven't even had my Wheaties yet today.
Well, we're going a little overtime today. Hey, for John Arizzi, I'm Tim Petre. We'll see you next time.